This is another iRaw podcast.
And we have been, in kind of Western society, been such a visual kind of focused culture that sound has been ignored for so long. And so there's this immense kind of repository of information or of information about relationships or politics or whatever is important to you that we just have completely ignored for a long time. Mm. Not completely ignored. That's not fair. There have been lots of people doing work on sound. But I think sort of this recent attention to sound, part of the kind of sensory turn, is this idea that like there's all this information there that we've kind of been missing out on.
Welcome back to The Animal Turn, everyone. This is episode 10 of season 4, where we've been focusing in on animals and sound. And as always, we finish off the season with a grad review. And in today's grad review, I'm going to be speaking to two exceptional graduate students. So the first is someone who I know really well, and that's Hannah Hunter. You've gotten to know her a little bit too throughout the course of the season. She's done a wonderful job with the animal highlights and will join us at the end of this episode for the final highlight. But a little bit about Hannah, she is a critical and creative geographer interested in human-animal relationships, bird sounds, and the history of science. She's a PhD candidate in the Geography and Planning Department here at Queen's University, but also tends to align herself quite strongly with STS, the Science and Technology Studies. Her doctoral research explores the more than human histories of bird sound recording and asks how these recordings can be reimagined and repurposed towards abundant multi-species futures. In particular, she is interested in ivory-billed woodpeckers, Atlantic puffins, and barred owls. Barred owls? So Hannah is a wonderful scholar and a friend of mine, and she, throughout this episode, kind of gives lots of interesting tidbits and thoughts about how we think about sound and the ways in which sound is used. The other graduate student who's going to be joining us today is also fantastic, and that's Bailey Hilgren. She is a musicologist and sound studies scholar about to begin her PhD in ethnomusicology at New York University. Her most recent research project traced environmentalists' construction of a wilderness area in northern Minnesota as a primarily silent place, an idea and legal practice that has undermined non-human animal agency and limited Ojibwa sovereignty in related but distinct ways. Bailey has explored soundscapes of recently burned areas in Oregon. She's also looked at data sonification as an art-science collaboration, Anthropocene technology, as well as historical conceptions of nature in both romantic and classical music. So she has a wide array of interests in sound, animals, and music. And she holds a master's degree in environmental studies from the University of Oregon and historical musicology from Florida State University. And you'll hear throughout this episode that Bailey and Hannah really complement one another well. Hannah actually points this out right in the beginning of the episode, stating that, you know, Bailey's got a really strong focus and interest in music, whereas Hannah has a really strong interest in kind of thinking about how data and sound is recorded and perceived, especially historically. So it's a great conversation. As always, grad reviews are a wonderful opportunity to kind of reflect on some of the tensions and core themes that emerge throughout the season. And I think we do a good job in this kind of hour-long discussion of unpacking those. So this is a great place to either start or end the season. But while we're here at the end, I just wanted to say thank you, as always, listeners, for listening, for being here with us. I'm happy to report that we have now clocked 14,000 downloads, which is always really, really exciting. As this is the final episode of the season, I just want to carve out a spot of extra time to say thank you so much for the season's sponsors. Thank you to Animals and Philosophy, Politics, Law and Ethics, Apple, for sponsoring the podcast generally, as well as a thank you to the Sonic Arts of Place Studio and the Sonic Arts Studio, both of which are here at Queen's University. But I'll tell you more about what the next season is going to entail at the end of the episode. For now, let's get to it. Enjoy the conversation. Welcome to The Animal Turn, Bailey and Hannah.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you.
Hannah's an old hand. And for those of you who have listened to the season so far, you would have heard Hannah giving us the animal highlights throughout the season. It's been really great so far. So thank you, Hannah, for joining us for the grad review. And
no Bailey, problem.
You are joining us for the first time. So welcome. It's been a really great season. And I'm always delighted with the grad reviews because it gives me an opportunity to go back and listen to everything. And the season's been quite spread out. Being able to go back to kind of the earlier episodes and get a sense of how many ideas kind of emerged from when Brian first introduced us to soundscapes, to talking about sonic methods with Jonathan, to ending up here with back communication with Gloriana. It's been a really like cool season with a lot of stuff coming up. So I'm excited to talk to you both today to just kind of pull apart some of the overlaps in terms of the concepts that we discussed in the season, but also potentially some of the tensions and challenges that you think come up when thinking about how we can do research with animals and thinking about the significance of sound in terms of understanding animals and their lives. But as always, before we get into the actual thick of the episode itself, first let's learn a little bit about you. So Bailey, maybe we can start with you. Could you tell us a little bit about yourself and what kind of research you're doing?
Yeah, absolutely. So I kind of loosely consider myself a musicologist and sound studies scholar. I say loosely because I'm always probing at the boundaries around the word music, which I think we'll be able to come back to lots in this episode. So I recently completed a master's degree in environmental studies at the University of Oregon. I have a master's in historical musicology, and I'm about to move to New York City, the big city, to start a PhD program in ethnomusicology at New York University. So a lot of my work explores the ways hierarchies in how that structure, how we think about human and nature relationships, how those hierarchies manifest in sound. So oftentimes that involves questions about what sounds mean, what counts as music, what doesn't count as music, conversations about noise versus sound and all of that. So I was incredibly excited to be invited to be part of the season because it is so right up my alley.
I have a
background in biology. My undergraduate studies were in biology and music performance. And so I also really love thinking about boundaries between disciplines and how we're approaching sometimes the same question from a different discipline and how that changes the answers that we might get or the questions we might ask in the first place.
So, my goodness, I feel like I couldn't have asked for a better grad student.
Yeah.
you've got all of the connections there, which is really, really, really cool. I mean, even with the episode with Martin, when I'd said I hadn't thought about music really and the significance of music to animals. So kind of having you here and someone who actually understands music and kind of some of those connections, I'm excited to unpack that a bit more with you. And New York. Yay!
A big change. I'm from rural Minnesota, so it's about as different as you can get.
So is this for a PhD program?
It is. Yep.
And who are you going to be working with there?
I'll be working with an ethnomusicologist named Martin Daughtry. He does really incredible work on music and sound and violence, and he's starting to get into some more questions about, he always has, but in a more explicit way, questions about environmental damage, and the Anthropocene with lots of asterisks next to it, So I'm incredibly excited about that. It's a great program in part because they ask you to do sort of traditional research, but also to make sounds and to incorporate sound making as part of your own kind of academic practice. So again, so many themes that we talked about or that were talked about in the podcast season that are just popping up in my life too.
So. Awesome. Well, it's great to have you here. And I look forward to seeing what you kind of start to produce. And at the end of the episode, maybe we can talk a little bit more about kind of where you see your research going and what you think you might do in that project, because it sounds fascinating. So Hannah and I actually know each other quite well. We're in the same grad program. We're fellows in arms. I don't know how to say metaphors. I'm just the worst with metaphors. But Hannah and I are two of the only people that I know that are actually working on animal studies related stuff in our department. So it's really, really special for me to have her involved in this season. But Hannah, could you tell us a little bit about, for the listeners who don't know you as well as I do, a little bit about who you are and how you and what your research is about?
Sure. So first of all, I want to say, Bailey, your work sounds so interesting. And I think it's cool because we both are coming from quite different perspectives. I feel like music is the parts of the season that I felt like I have the least kind of knowledge and to speak on. So I think it's going to work well. But anyway, I kind of come from this human-animal studies interest and what role sound has in human-animal relationships. So I'm in a geography department, but I'm kind of sort of a bit of a geographer, but a lot of a science and technology studies person. So actually right now I'm at Cornell as a visiting fellow at their SDS department. And so, yeah, I'm interested in human-animal relationships through sound, and I'm particularly interested in extinct and endangered animals and what role sound plays as like a way we can know extinct and endangered animals, especially from the past, as well as ways that sound is used to resist extinction and communicate extinction and things like that. So earlier in this season, I introduced in one of the animal highlights, one of my main case studies, which is about the ivory-billed woodpecker and how sound is used in these attempts to find this species that's thought to be extinct. And I also spent a lot of time in the archives looking at these historical sound recording expeditions and things like that. So yeah, sound and extinction. And
amazing.
All the things in between.
And I love that animal highlight when you spoke about that. It still sticks in my mind now, that idea of intergenerational communication. I'd never, that for me was such a profound idea that, like speaking to the part, I still don't know how to articulate it properly, but just that idea I think is really transgressive, because we do kind of use animal sounds as stand-ins, right? As kind of sonic specimens, to use Rachel's concept, right? As it just stands in for the whole species. So yeah, it's really great. I think you guys do come from quite different branches. And then of course, I'm also a geographer, but I have more historical interests and my knowledge on sound is really quite rudimentary. So hopefully the three of us can generate some cool ideas here. So let's get into it then. This is just a general kind of open conversation where we can try and pull together some of these episodes and think through some of the overlaps and the tensions. So what for you guys were maybe some of the, I guess, standout overlaps or themes for you? What really came through in the season as an important theme to unpack and consider if you are interested in the relationship between animals and sound, or using sound to understand animals?
Yeah, so I can jump in. So this may be in part because of how the season was sort of front-loaded with methods and then got progressively a little bit more theoretical as it went along. But I think questions about methods, both of, I guess, of listening, recording, and collecting sound, and how all of the methods, in the sciences, I think we sometimes think of methods as neutral. Of course, that's never going to be true. Mm-hmm. And a couple of the guests made that very clear, including especially like Rachel Mundy's work. But those methods are always going to be imbued with values. Yeah, I think that was an important theme throughout the whole season.
Yeah, totally. I also kind of underlined method and listening, and I really enjoyed listening to Jonathan again. I think he kind of outlined so many of these methods in quite clear and distinct ways. And it was neat because we did start off with methods kind of strong, go into theory, and then we ended with two episodes, I think, speaking to ecologists who were, you know, both Gloriana and Denise, I think, were just going out into the field collecting this data. And both with them and Mickey, I found myself constantly being like, well, what are the ethics of these methods? What are the ethics of this methods? And I think it raised interesting, definitely interesting questions about how we do this research, that it isn't value neutral completely.
Yeah, I couldn't sort of stop thinking about the ant recording that Jonathan played. And yeah, like you asked a question, Claudia, about kind of the potential invasiveness of this kind of putting this contact microphone sort of into their homes, and like what impact that had on them. But then at the same time, this is this really kind of intimate way that we can listen to ants, you know, and like that might change kind of our politics and the way that we think about these species. So how do we balance kind of those two things? And I think like in the humanities, perhaps, especially animal studies scholars, we're much more likely to kind of, well, I don't know, I feel like we would think about those things kind of by default, whereas sound might generally seem like a less invasive method than other methods, right? Where it's better than cutting animals open, it's better than, you know, all these other things. But there's still, you know, ethical ways to think about it.
Mm. And I think what for me was really pertinent to this was came up with a couple of people, I think with Cheryl, with Jonathan, and with Rachel, is the idea of valuation. What is valued, mm-hmm. right? What is the intention of doing this research? Is it just for, is it just because it's cool and it's fun? And there is something, like Gloriana also said, there is something to be said for curiosity, for curiosity's sake, you know, but at what cost, right? And for what value? So is it just to get a good sound? And to not ask these questions, I think is a, even sometimes in my posing it, I sometimes like, am I being too sensitive? Am I poking in areas where maybe I should just leave it? Because understanding ants, like you say, it's going to really change, could be really important for them. But are we just using conservation as a shorthand then to do whatever we want, kind of thing?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And how do you quantify that? You know, how can you quantify what impact something like that will have? It's a tricky question for sure.
Yeah, I think also the issue of whether or not we are able to ask for consent when we're creating sound recording, you know, this is something that we think about a fair amount in ethnomusicology. When we're going out and doing field work and talking with humans, we always have to go through a pretty intense, you know, ethics review, including especially if you're going to be working with vulnerable populations. And so, you know, my past research project I did, pre-pandemic plans were to conduct quite a few interviews, both with Ojibwe people, but then also to do sort of a multi-species ethnographic project. And in writing up my, you know, IRB request, I kept having to write that I, you know, understood that I needed to ask for consent to record the humans. But I regularly wrote in, and my advisor had me take out sometimes comments about, well, I need to ask for consent, you know, for some of these non-human creatures mm-hmm. as well. Mm-hmm. And he kept saying, well, you know, one, you're maybe poking into something, again, like you're saying, Claudia, that I don't need to be poking in. Maybe that's creating more problems for myself than is worth it. Yeah, but it just opens up a whole kind of sticky situation where you're asking for consent for one group and not for another.
Is, I'm guessing an IRB is the ethics clearance, so to get like ethics to do research. Yeah. That's I think anthrozoology, there's an anthrozoology podcast, I'll put it in the show notes, that actually speaks a lot about this kind of tension. And Lauren Van Patt also recently published a paper on unpacking and thinking through how we're not expected to ask or do ethics reviews when we're involving animals and animal subjects. And I get it. Like as we, part of the reason why I stuck to doing archives and historical research was because I didn't want to go through the whole ethics process because it can delay an entire project. And again, that maybe speaks to why do we have to do ethics today versus, you know.
Right. Why didn't we have to do ethics for archives? That's interesting.
Yeah. but then it does, like it becomes burdensome for you as an individual trying to like carry these things. But still there is, again, a point to who we care for, right? Like we think about our human subjects and we realize that our presence can greatly impact them and their worlds and their economies and what they do, but we don't think about that for animals, right?
Yeah. Well, I was thinking in the interview with the Cheryl Tip, which was one of my favorite episodes this season. It was so cool. But she was talking about when you had a conversation about copyright and about kind of the recordist copyright and how that needs to be protected and everything. But, you know, you could think of, well why does the human get to own that animal sound, you know? Like that, I guess, comes kind of naturally, but you kind of extract these sounds without permission, like presumably, and then you can kind of own that and create capital from that, right? And yeah, it would obviously be tricky to figure out another way of doing it.
But again, are we just creating problems? Like is there an inherent problem in a human owning a recording? And I think there might be, but But is there, do you know what I mean? Are we just creating as critical scientists and scholars, are we just saying, ugh, there's a problem in us being the ones who own it? What do you guys think? I've got ideas, but I'm curious to hear what you guys think.
I feel like I need to qualify my point in that I know that, like, obviously that the sound recorders is doing a lot of work there, right? They're not just like taking something and saying it's theirs. Like, obviously there's a creative practice and like a lot of work that goes into that, right? So I do think that they should have some ownership over the sound, but yeah, sorry, Bailey, I looked like you're about to say something. So.
No. I have lots of thoughts that I'm still kind of working through how to put words to them about this kind of practice in acoustic ecology, especially of amassing massive collections of recordings, you know, sometimes just tons and tons of sound files. And I think some of my reservations about that practice, because I do totally understand how that's useful, you know, as Brian Pijanowski was making very clear in his episode, and I think Mickey Valley did a good job of explaining why that's important too, Cheryl also. But I think the practice often feels quite a bit like an attempt to sort of conquer exotic animal sounds all across the world. It's like a practice of like going to a new place, you know, not your backyard, not necessarily your dog or your cat or the squirrels, you know, on your porch, but you're going to like a so-called exotic locale and trying to collect as many sounds as you can in like this sort of Pokemon-esque, like gotta collect them all. And I think that's, my feelings about ownership of recordings, it's all tied up with the practice of how those recordings are you know, gotten in the first place.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. Part of what I'm looking at in the archives right now is these really early recording expeditions where the Cornell Lab of Ornithology had people kind of stationed, or people they knew all over the world, like generally white people often on colonial expeditions and things like that, who would send recordings back like from places like East Africa and Puerto Rico and Brazil. And it's like, how do we think about that? You know, there's been a lot of research on like collection ecologies and how like the collection of dead animal skins and things like that was tied up in the colonial project. And sound recordings certainly were too, and perhaps still are.
Yeah, and I mean, I think Rachel brought this through really well in her discussion of sonic specimen and how kind of these valuations are historical and they inscribe both people and animals in very particular ways in terms of how we understand them. And I think, you know, the ownership model is kind of part of this. The idea that everything is property is kind of part of these histories. And I think what you were saying there, Bailey, about kind of getting the exotic sound, like the idea, and again, what is exotic to who, right? So who's doing these collections? Because not everything is exotic everywhere, because somewhere it's a normal sound, right? But in asking Cheryl, for example, with the archive about what sounds people submit, people don't submit the everyday, normal, ordinary sounds. They're submitting, I like your Pokemon kind of thing, they submit the sounds that they think others will find interesting or that they think are somehow exotic. And as you were talking, that kind of got me thinking about where you might find these different sonic specimens. So in the British Library archive, you'll find maybe a lot of these kinds of sounds of wild animals, etc. But if you were to go to, let's say, a welfare institute or like an agricultural sciences lab, you'd probably have loads of recordings of animals. So then, I'm kind of like thinking as we're going here, but what work are these collections doing, right? When you start to have collections of cow sounds and pig sounds as a means of controlling them, how do these operate different? Does that make sense? I don't know if I'm making any sense.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. I don't know. I also, part of me also wonders, you know, it's so resource intensive to amass these collections in the first place. You know, it's totally. The archiving of the recordings once they're already made, I almost think of as a separate practice. But the like oftentimes like jet setting, like going as far as you can to like, you know, travel to these places. And it's so resource intensive. I oftentimes find myself wondering, well, you know, is there possibly some sort of better use for some of those resources that might be able to provide more direct care for animals or to intervene in some of these, you know, actually violent, like overtly violent acts rather than epistemologically violent acts.
Yeah. I recently went to a talk by Mark Peter Wright, who's a sound studies researcher, and he was speaking about the ecosonic footprint, I think, of sound recording and all the things that we don't hear when we hear a sound recording, and like all of the resource extraction that's used to create microphones and like the plastic casing and like all of these things. And, you know, you don't hear the coughs of people whose lungs have been damaged through resource extraction that was created for these things. You don't hear the sounds of the airplanes that people take to travel across the world to take recordings, and all of this isn't to say that we shouldn't take recordings, right? But in environmental sound recordings, there's a lot of kind of aesthetics to it, right? You want to listen to all the nice parts of nature, but there are all of these kind of horrible sounds and environmental effects that are created kind of as a part of this industry too.
So what then, if we bring this back to kind of thinking about animals, because I think that is really an important point, is tying together kind of the material effects of doing research, and not just sonic research, any research. What does it mean to go to a specific place? What resources are you using to go to that place and do that research? And which animals and people is it impacting? That's a very material and important question, as well as what work does the research do, right? Like, how do we value this research? Who is it helping? Is it just a good career move? And I think this could be asked for any research project, right? I think all of us have done travel. Does that, like, we should all be asking questions. You know, people going up to the Arctic to understand climate change, taking a beef burger with them. There are contradictions. We have contradictions, and these contradictions should be spoken about. But I think then the question becomes is, what is this work doing for animals? And I think one thing for me that really stood out in this season was that as much as there are these questions and important ethical questions that need to be grappled with, sound seems to present a really interesting and unique and potentially transformative way of understanding animals and their worlds that could change their worlds, right? That could maybe bring people to attention. So maybe we could talk a bit more about that, kind of bring animals in and what you think the usefulness is for sound and sound research and kind of understanding animals and their worlds.
Yeah. So this is a question that I grapple with all the time is what does sound actually tell us about the world? You know, I come from a tradition of studying music. And when we study music, there's, you know, a great deal that can be learned about the people who are creating the music or the animals, you know, if you want to extend music to that length. But I think the place that I've arrived with this, and this is maybe not a particularly satisfying answer, but the spot that I'm resting for now is that sound is sort of just, to me, I understand it as just another artifact of the world, or just another kind of piece of evidence of our interactions, you know, between humans and animals, animals to other animals, animals with their environments. And we have been, in kind of Western society, been such a visual kind of focused culture that sound has been ignored for so long. And so there's this immense kind of repository of information or of information about relationships or politics or whatever is important to you that we just have completely ignored for a long time. Mm. Not completely ignored. That's not fair. There have been lots of people doing work on sound. But I think sort of this recent attention to sound, part of the kind of sensory turn, is this idea that, like, there's all this information there that we've kind of been missing out on. So there's a scholar named Jonathan Stern, who's a sound studies scholar, and he very famously wrote about what he calls the audiovisual litany. So it's this kind of body of myths about sound versus the visual that are pervasive in society. And some of the ideas are that, you know, hearing is immersive, whereas like the visual provides some sort of perspective. Sound is immediate, whereas the visual is at arm's length. You know, all of these kind of tropes about sound, and he goes through and he kind of dismantles them and pokes at them until you get to this point where you're like, well, I'm not actually sure sound is all that special. I don't know that I entirely agree with that, because it feel like my soul and my heart tell me that there's something really special about sound as someone who spends most of my time listening and creating sounds as a musician, but I'm just not sure. I'm just not sure.
Mm. Yeah, I'm glad you brought up Jonathan Stern, because I think a lot of those of us in sound studies do really struggle with that, because you kind of start, and I started with this kind of feeling that the sound was this like amazing way that we can connect with non-human beings. And I do think it still is. Like, I think that it is different. And that's not to say that the other senses don't matter. But I think it can be this kind of like empathetic and like quite kind of deeply relational way of relating to animals and kind of sharing space with them. I mean, kind of thinking about this idea of Republic of Noise that was brought up through the season and things like that. But yeah, in terms of how doing this research changes animals' lives, there's kind of, I guess, a more easy answer to that, which is thinking about the ways in which it has been used in science and conservation to directly improve animals' lives. Like instances where in the Great Barrier Reef, they've played fish sounds from the reefs in order to repopulate them.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, which is really cool. And all of these, it's happened a lot in bird conservation too, kind of repopulating certain places for puffins, and it's a lot in the seabird research. But then it's also been used for ill. There are all of these kind of sonic hunting devices where you can kind of play sound recordings of animals to harm them. And I think Cheryl might have mentioned this in her, I know that she's talked about this in other ways, like when you have these big open access sound archives, you don't really have any say over what people use them for. So people might use them for hunting or pest control or kind of any number of things, and people do, right? So I think it's important not to be like sound and animals is always like this lovely story, because it sometimes isn't. Like, it can be quite aggressive as well.
I guess it's like any technology. So like Bailey said, you know, it is an artifact, but how we do it how we do it is where the kind of, I always want to say where the meat is, but I'm really trying to find better metaphors. where the juice is. There we go with that. It's where the crux is. There we go. What you do with the sound, and we have no, like, we could talk about social media as being transformative and incredible for a lot of people, as well as extremely destructive, right? So it does have potential in both ways. But I think there is an emotive component to sound. The sound of the wolf, I don't know if you guys remember the sound of the wolf, but that just stuck with me completely. And again, I could listen to that sound again and again without it. It makes me want to relate to them, or the sounds of the bats. And this was a really cool thing in the season, was we were actually able to bring in some of the sounds. And these are animals who I've never heard in my own kind of life or world. And hearing them kind of, it gave me goosebumps. I sat and I felt as though I was in relation, and that they were significant, and that they are in the world. And that was very different to me to reading about wolves and imagining wolves. Kind of hearing a wolf and imagining then where they are and what they're doing was for me quite transformative. And I think that there is something to be said and done here as animal studies scholars in terms of how we could make animals more present in our research and more present in the imaginations of others, that sound affords us, whereas text doesn't. Another thing with this was a lot of people were talking about sound, but I sometimes felt like the animals weren't really being spoken of. So there's the talking about sound, and then there's the talking about animals. And sometimes you can lose sight of the animals in talking about the sound. So I guess I'm interested in how we start to marry those two.
Well, if it's okay, I was wanting to speak a little bit to the comment about making animals present through sound. You made me think of I keep coming back to Cheryl's because I listened to it the most recently, but it was also really great. But when she was talking about having these kind of listening events where you would kind of dim the lights down and have people just listen, and how, like, you know, that's kind of an uncomfortable thing for us because, like, you know, our society is like mostly visual. Like, it's just, you know, and it's how we get a lot of our information, and how that can be this kind of quite like deep way of like imagining the animals and kind of having them affect us. But yeah, I think it's something that in terms of how sound can make animals present in our research, like any animal studies scholar's research, we are kind of constrained in a lot of ways by main modes of academic communication, which is mostly textual and graphical. And as lots of people have worked against that. There are kind of lots of examples of people kind of releasing podcasts alongside their academic paper or things like that. But still, you know, it's difficult to kind of put that on a resume, and it might not count in kind of the same ways and stuff. And yeah, I guess that could be kind of a bit of an, you know, as much as Jonathan Stern wants to say that you know, sound isn't special, like it is true that, you know, main modes of academic communication, you know, the way that we think about knowledge is often very visual.
Yeah, I think because the ways we think about things is so often visual, sound has this sort of disruptive quality. And I don't know that it's something inherent to sound. It might be that, you know, if we only communicated in sound, if we, you know, and this is a lot of this too, is assuming hearing, you know, human animal scholars, you know, there's a lot to be said too for the blind and deaf, you know, folks who might be relating to these senses in different ways. Mm-hmm. But because we, you know, you go to an academic conference most of the time and you sit and you watch a PowerPoint and you watch the person speak and you're listening to the talk that they're giving, but it's sort of, you're expecting what that talk is going to be like. You expect that it's going to be their voice. At a music conference, there might be music kind of clips, but when I've presented at conferences outside of music and sound contexts, or like forums in general, whenever I play a sound of any sort, people go bonkers, like the eyes get wide and people like shift in their chairs. You know, I usually have to check to make sure there's the correct audiovisual equipment, and I always make sure to bring like a little Bluetooth speaker. So people, like, it's totally outside the norm of what we expect in academic work most of the time to incorporate these sounds. So I do think there's a lot to be said for, Claudia, I think the way you said it was, you know, making animals more present in our work. Like, actually, how can we incorporate animal voices into the work that we're doing? How about literally incorporating animal voices into the work that we're doing?
No, absolutely. Kind of, you know, something to be said for letting them speak for themselves. Although, of course, like, no, as we were just talking about, like, no recording is neutral, right? It's like a mediated representation through all the ways that, you know, who's recorded, when they're recorded, what technology is used to record them, and things like that too. So yeah, I guess I would say that any inclusion should probably also recognize that, right? You know, this isn't just the animal voice speaking for themselves.
This brings up some of what Eva Meyer was kind of talking about as well, I think, which is Eva Meyer and Jeremy Gordon, which I think is quite important. Is this idea of speaking and the politics of speaking, that who you listen to and who has an opportunity to voice is political. It's not neutral, but that we also have to kind of develop tools for listening. And I think when people kind of perk up, that says that they're, like you said, it is transgressive. It is kind of subversive. And I wonder if, like, you dropped a smell bomb, you know, people might not be as keen, you know, like, this is what they smell like. So it's kind of transgressive in the right quantities of transgressive, if that makes sense, which might be really transformative to some extent. So far, we've spoken a fair bit, and we've been at it for now, and we started with just talking about the themes, but I think we've brought up a couple of tensions as well. So just to kind of bring things together, so we've spoken about kind of methods are really significant, important, that there are a variety of different methods that came up, but that there's a whole host of ethical questions that need to be asked, and we don't have conclusions or answers for that, but that definitely the questions about the ethics of how these methods happen should be asked. We've spoken a little bit about the significance of sound. So is sound significant, and who is it significant for? For our careers, for animals, for conservation, how are the ways in which sound is valued, and in what ways do those valuations make animals present or not present? So I think we've touched on these two things, and we've also kind of spoken a little bit, I guess, about kind of the politics of voice and speaking, as well as the politics of listening. So I think those are the three, and the fact that these are all kind of bound up also in institutional restrictions and institutional expectations, both at the individual level and the university level. As far as I think these are the three that we've touched on so far. Before we kind of start getting into quotes and things, are there other kind of really important themes that you think we should be fleshing out here in this grad review?
I think we managed to quickly cover all the things that I had written down. Like, yes, I did write that down.
Nailed it.
Yeah. Hang on. I was actually interested, as I said, like music was the kind of the stuff that I think was most outside of my own comfort zone. And I guess because Bailey, that's kind of your area. I'd just be interested as to what you thought about, you know, the way that music was talked about in this season. And yeah, Claudia kind of challenged me when we did the animal highlight on injury lemurs. And I was talking about how, you know, these are the only mammals that have rhythm or whatever. And she was like, well, what is rhythm? I was like, I don't know. I just thought it was cool, you know? And like the question as well is like, what is music? Like the animals I usually look at aren't like songbirds, but usually more like squawky, pecky birds, you know? So, and that's a question too, like why are some birds songbirds and some birds aren't considered songbirds? Anyway, sorry, I buried the question there, but I just wanted you to talk a bit about how you felt about, yeah, the music side of things.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I love talking about this. And a lot of, I will say before I even dive in, a lot of my thoughts on this are pretty much directly developed out of Rachel Mundy's work. I'm like a super fan of hers. She like is one of the people who like personally brought me into animal sounds and thinking about some of these questions. So, but I think this idea of how we define what music is often so tied, it's so bound up with questions about who matters, but what, you know, what we're valuing. So that's true, like all the way through a hierarchy that we might think of as like structuring society. So that's true of humans and animals. You know, you ask someone is, you know, do animals create music? And they might scoff. Some people might not. Animal scholars probably would not, but a lot of people would scoff. A lot of people have scoffed when I actually talk about it, you know, because animals are in some way below humans, and music is this kind of special thing that humans create. In that's, these are not my beliefs; these are kind of broad kind of myths in within culture. But I mean, that question about what music is also structures so much about human-human relationships too. So you really can trace this all the way through a hierarchy. You know, you might hear someone say, "Well, you know, this person who lives in the apartment next to me always plays hip hop. Like, that's not music, that's just noise," which obviously has like deeply racialized kind of a belief embedded in there. And so this question about what music is or what music is not, and likewise questions about what sound is versus noise, you know, some of the amazing kind of conversations throughout the season, those are all bound up with some of these hierarchical kind of structures within our thinking about what's good and what's bad, what's nature and what's human, you know, assuming that there are these separations between all of us. So, and I think too, the question about whether or not something is music, Rachel, I think, said this in her episode, is usually the wrong question. And this calls out to something that Ava Meyer was saying too. Instead of thinking of a political system, a human political system, and then bringing animals into it, like the system is inherently not built to incorporate animal communication. Like music systems, the ways we think about music, like the concept itself is not built to incorporate animals necessarily. And so instead of trying to bring animals into music, why not kind of create something new together, mm-hmm. like in a more collaborative way? So those are just some of my thoughts about
I think music and animals. Both Martin and Jeremy kind of would join you here. So I think, I loved both of those episodes, because Martin was like, what is music? If anything, musicologists today, if they're worth anything, will say that they don't know what it is, yeah. which is kind of great. And then also when he kind of put to the foreground that animals are making sound and music for themselves, regardless of what we're doing. So to kind of decenter the fact that we are the ones that are sounding everything. And then, I mean, Jeremy just had this really beautiful way of talking, of saying like, we are sounding together and apart and together, and we're making the world, and let's do noise together. And I mean, I think I was sometimes a bit more like critical or hesitant of the directions he was going. I was like, wait, but hang on, we have to draw lines somewhere. You know, it's one thing to say that we're sounding together, but what are the implications of this? So yeah, I think, I mean, Martin's episode, I just had so much fun talking to him. His knowledge was so, at least for me, and I know Hannah, you weren't asking me this question, but for me, like the idea of how diverse it could be once you start looking at those connections between music and animals, the materiality of the instrument. So he just touched on that, but it was something I had never thought of, that the strings on an instrument, that what an instrument is made of actually involves animal death, and whose bodies are being used to make human music is, you know, the kind of, yeah. It was really...
There's a really excellent edited collection that came out, I think, last year or the year before, called Audible Infrastructures. And hopefully you can put it in the show notes. But it touched on a lot of those themes about what, I mean, it wasn't just about animals, but there were some bits in it which talked about, you know, these kind of environmental entanglements that and everything that's kind of behind these like instruments and gramophones and all these things like this. And I guess that, yeah, comes back again to that question of like, what do we not hear when we listen to an animal through these means, or what do we not hear when we listen to someone strumming on a Gibson guitar which was made from mahogany from Fiji, right? There's a chapter in that book about that. But
and I guess anyone who does a commodity chain analysis, and I think this kind of comes back to consumerism, whether you're consuming a sound, whether you're consuming an instrument, whether you're consuming music, is kind of what does it compel you, or who does it compel you to attend to? And whose needs and wants are you being, you know, like a common practice now for me whenever I buy anything is to pick up and see what the ingredients are and where it was made and how it was made. And I think that there is a labor, but I think it's really important to do. Coming back to kind of some of the themes. So outside of kind of listening and method and significance, for me, some themes that really also still emerged that I just wanted to kind of highlight here quickly was kind of the idea, and you were touching on it a bit here, Bailey, as well, is the taxonomy of sound, that there is a kind of ordering to sound, and that the sounds, we spoke about value, but that there is kind of a hierarchy and a value and an ordering to the sounds that we value, both in terms of humans and animals, but also in terms of how humans and animals come together. Another really important thing for me that came up in the season was how significant it is to think about bodies and how bodies sound. Mm-hmm. So you mentioned there, for example, people who engage or interact with sound differently, but so do animals, right? Some animals don't have ears. Some animals are using vibrations to interact. So there are numerous, and this for me was quite startling, as I always think about sound as something I hear, but actually that sound is also something you feel, and it involves kind of movements in air, and vibrations of sound are also important. So that for me was kind of important as well. And then something else that stood out for me was place and kind of the geography of sounds. And this came up a bit when we were talking about exotic. So cities, again, and the significance of cities and the sounds they make, but also the kind of mapping of sounds and the showing of where sounds come from. So these were also just kind of some themes for me that emerged. And I don't know if maybe I'll give you guys a opportunity now to quickly rattle off some additional themes that you'd like us to see, and then we'll go to quotes.
You go ahead, Anna.
I just had one. I mean, I think we covered so much in such a short time, which is great. One thing that I was kind of noting down was, and it particularly came up towards the end of the season, was about the charismatic species and about funding, which I thought was really interesting. And actually, it did come up earlier. I know Jonathan talked about it and things, but not only who we record, but what animals do we think about when we think about sound, and what gets funding, and what is kind of the exciting ones, and what are the less exciting ones, and like, well, how do we make those valuations, I guess.
Yeah, like maybe I would have been more transformative if I had dedicated a whole show to pigs instead of to bats and dolphins, right? Because those are the two species that you do think of when you think of sound.
Well, I was kind of trying to push against that in Animal Highlights, just to a certain extent. And like the research on spiders, it was like so interesting. Think about sound, we don't think about spiders, but when we do think about sound and spiders, then this whole amazing world opens up, right? So
ninja spiders.
Yep. Ninja, supersonic, listening through their feet. Yeah, it's just so cool. But
yeah, I think that some of your examples, Hannah, and I loved every single animal highlight. Oh, they were, you know, some of my very favorite things, you know, when listening to each episode. I got to like look forward to it as like a little dessert at the end. I think some of your examples did such a good job at like totally doing this project, or like contributing to this project of decentering what sound may be. So I talked a lot about like decentering what music is, and like maybe we have to come up with some sort of new conception of what music is. But I think that's true of sound too. And Claudia, when you were talking about how different animals, you know, listen differently, different humans listen differently, you know, we're all such kind of individuals with our each of our own kind of different sets of physiologies and things like that. And I think that's a really powerful lesson in sound, is that it forces us, when we think about animals and sound, it forces us to go outside of what we think sound might be, to go outside of what listening might be. Maybe it's not just with an ear that's structured like a human ear, but maybe it's with a web, you know, or some sort of other structure like that, which I thought was really beautiful. And a possible additional answer to the question of, you know, well, what might sound tell us that we might not be able to get from other kind of areas.
And I love the scale, like scale was a thing that came up in here, kind of even in terms of thinking of specimen. So an individual who listens and how their world is shaped by listening, or losing hearing, or losing the ability to engage with someone because they can't hear because the environment's too loud or whatever it is. There's the individual level, there's the kind of species level at which conservation is using sound, but then there's, you know, these institutional levels of funding that value sound. So there are these kinds of, and then of course the specimen that kind of stands in as a as an example for a whole species. Oh, and in the case of the ivory bull, you know, for all time, you know, like this is what they sound like for all time. Mm-hmm. And then you start to think about species that have different dialects and different accents and different cultures, and you think, oh, there's something not quite right there for using a single animal as a stand-in for a whole. So yeah, I think scale is really important there. And again, this brings up the kind of politics of sound. It's not just neutral, to bring us back to the beginning. So we're going to start wrapping up now. So I'm going to invite each of you to read your quote. Feel free to kind of respond to the other, and maybe just give us a sense of where, you know, what inspired you to use this quote, and then we'll take it from there. So Bailey, why don't we start with you?
Yeah, so I had a really hard time narrowing this down, of course, as I'm sure all of the participants in the podcast did. But I especially love the writing of Rebecca Solnit, not necessarily directly about animals, but about some of the things that motivate, you know, kind of, if I'm just talking about myself, that motivate me to remain hopeful, and not in a like kind of naive way, but in a real way. So this is a bit from her book, Hope in the Dark. It's important to say what hope is not. It is not the belief that everything was, is, or will be fine. The evidence is all around us of tremendous suffering and tremendous destruction. The hope I'm interested in is about broad perspectives with specific possibilities, ones that invite or demand that we act. Patrice Cullors, one of the founders of Black Lives Matter, early on described the movement's mission as to, quote, provide hope and inspiration for collective action to build collective power to achieve collective transformation, rooted in grief and rage, but pointed towards vision and dreams.
Beautiful. Yeah. And what for you, why was this quote important for you in terms of thinking about the season and tying things together?
Yeah, so I think sound for me has been kind of my entry point into understanding some of these really, the ways that we're all always stuck together. We're all bound up in all of this muck together. You know, I have done a lot of work on soundscapes and thinking about, well, when we listen in a place, how are all of the sounds that we're hearing stuck together or entangled with one another? And you come away from it, you know, this is sort of a classic ecology sort of maxim almost, but that everything is all stuck together. There's the famous John Muir quote, of course, about, you know, you pick one thing and everything else comes with it. And so I think this idea, not to quote John, I'm not a John Muir fan or anything like that. He's actually a pretty bad guy, but this idea of like
shots fired.
I'm so sorry. I gotta say it, but this idea that, you know, collective action, we're all working together, humans, animals alike, to build collective power, kind of solidarity alongside one another to achieve collective transformation, because it's bad for animals, it's bad for humans, it's bad for animals and humans together, you know, all sorts of different animals, all sorts of different humans. So I really like the way Rebecca Solnit calls out to this idea that we're all kind of working in solidarity with one another.
And I think it's, I mean, things there are, depending on where you're looking, and I think certainly there are many, many around the world that would say things are looking pretty bleak, but there is also still beauty somehow in how we do things together. And I think there is kind of hope in that. And for me, now that you've kind of pried it apart, even, you know, as a social scientist and as someone who sometimes I think thinks about things with open endings, and I don't necessarily have these kind of closed answers. I'm more interested in kind of the questions that open things up. And that can sometimes be challenging when trying to communicate, I think, to people who maybe come from a more natural sciences perspective or a more biological perspective where they're looking for clean-cut answers. And as I progressed through the season, more and more I was kind of struck by the differences in communicating, but also in how we are all in our own ways trying to improve the world. And that actually we really need to find ways of communicating across these kinds of social sciences and physical sciences, because we do not only sound together, but we can, working together, really transform things in meaningful ways. So yeah, that's really beautiful. Hannah, any thoughts or you want to share yours?
I was just thinking about how different my quote is, but that's great. We can talk about John Muir another time. It's one of those things that, you know, when you're in the humanities, we all kind of, a lot of us have these like shared critical ideas, and then you talk to people kind of outside and they're like, whoa, what are you talking about?
But yeah, that's what I feel like right now. I'm like, okay,
we'll talk later.
I wasn't sure what I wanted to say as my quote, and throughout the season there was a lot of, you know, great quotes about animals and nature, and these kind of like hopeful and like sometimes kind of devastating quotes. But I wanted to use this opportunity to talk about Dylan Robinson's work, who is, he was at Queen's University, but he's just moved on to University of British Columbia. He's on my PhD committee, Stolo Indigenous Sound Studies researcher. But so he is sort of preamble, because this quote kind of, I need to quantify it a bit, but there we go. We've both got our hungry listening. It's funny. I feel like a lot of musicologists know a lot about this book, but I feel like it hasn't kind of come into the animals and sound world, which is why I wanted to talk about it now. But Dylan talks about how we all have listening positionalities and how kind of listening isn't this kind of neutral act in the same way that recording isn't. And he talks about how kind of there's a settler colonial positionality, which is very much kind of about extraction and pinning down sound. And here's a quote from his book. The listening continuum has historically been consigned to a framework wherein one is listening well if one is able to capture the content of what is spoken or the fact of musical form and structure. Hungry listening prioritizes the capture and certainty of information over the effective feel, timbre, touch, and texture of sound. So hungry listening is this term for this kind of extractive and fervent, like a lot of this. So Rachel Mundy kind of noted on this about kind of this vivisection and this kind of trying to kind of take sounds apart. Yeah, I guess I just wanted to mention Dylan and thinking that this is an important thing to think about with animals and sound too, right? Like sound isn't just something that we should that we should try, you know, to find the fact and what does it mean and what, you know, but we can sort of accept it as this affective, timbrous qualities too.
Yeah. I think that's beautiful, because I think it does tie together a lot of the themes we were talking about, kind of this idea and this needing and wanting to taxonomize everything. So who was it that spoke about kind of bird sounds? And now you've got, I think it was Rachel as well, like bird sounds, there's a particular like 1-2-1-2, and then that's how the song is defined. Or like there is this way of kind of making sound sterile, I guess, to some extent.
Yeah, so hungry listening is kind of this terminology that Dylan Robinson created for kind of this kind of rooted in like the original kind of colonial project in the US, which was, it comes from like formal music education. Like it's still kind of present in a lot of the ways that we're kind of taught to listen. You know, you sit quietly in class and you don't talk and you listen, and that's how you kind of gather facts. And it's sort of this like hierarchical thing, and Dylan sort of talks about how in indigenous ways of listening are very different different to that. And I would really encourage anyone who's interested in sound at all to read that book, because I am not doing it even the slightest bit of justice. And I think there's a lot of relevance to it, and things like bioacoustics and these kind of fervent kind of collection of bird sound. And you know, a lot of it now, the way that bioacoustics is it's not as much listening as it is kind of visualizing and machine learning and all these things like that. And how do we kind of think about those things together? Anyway, I'm rambling, but read the book.
Yeah, it's a pretty spectacular book. It like formed one of the kind of main theoretical pillars of some of the work that I just wrapped up here at the University of Oregon. But I think it's so important to Hannah that you brought that in here right at the end, because that is actually a theme that I forgot that I didn't bring up, but is about how, you know, potentially really enriching in the season might have been more connections between, you know, scholars outside of white kind of settler positionalities.
Absolutely.
And that's not to say all of the participants were, but thinking about relationships with animals outside of kind of some of these dominant positions. And Dylan Robinson does such an exceptional job at exploring the ways that really does, the positions that we're operating from really do structure how we listen, and how, not only how we listen, but how we act on our listening. So yeah, it's incredibly, incredibly important work.
Great. Thank you. Now I kind of wish I had known about it earlier, because then I could have spoken to Dylan and be like, hey, I should have thought about that. But yeah, I think this speaks to, this came up in other seasons as well, you know, where you start from does shape how you think about law or legal systems, how you think about experience, how you think about the city. These are really good tools. And I think we've learned a great deal in the season just about a variety of concepts. As someone who isn't from sound studies, it's opened up my kind of perspectives into terms of thinking about how I can think about experience of animals and the avenues that are open to me to do so. So thank you both of you for kind of helping me think through this a bit and think through kind of these connections. It's been really great. Before we wrap up, maybe you want to just give us a little bit about, because you've shared a bit about your work now, maybe what you're working on or in the future or heading towards, and or if people want to connect with you, how they can do so.
Yeah, I can. I just wrapped up writing a thesis about a wilderness area in northern Minnesota, the state that I'm from. And I'm still kind of riffing on that work, trying to shape it into something that might be able to go out into the world. But the project was about how this wilderness area has been constructed like via popular discourse, but also through conservationist work. As a distinctly silent wilderness place. And this is also a theme that came up throughout the season, is this kind of dichotomy of like nature as tranquil, cities as loud, you know, that kind of thing. But my project was tracing how this place, which is actually quite cacophonous in a beautiful way, was constructed as a silent place, and how that notion of silence was codified into legislation that now doesn't allow any motorboats to be used in the place, which is kind of good for animals. It majorly infringes on Ojibwe food sovereignty, ability to use their boats to go fishing. And I traced the ways that those issues, you know, the limiting of Ojibwe sovereignty and the trivializing of animal sounds are connected. So the ways animals and indigenous people, their fates are kind of tied together in that place. So, and then the other big project is moving to, you know, across the country to a big city, starting a PhD. nothing much.
Fascinating. Yeah. And you'll start that in September?
Yes.
Great. And if people want to get in touch with you, what would be the best way to do so?
Yeah. So I'm kind of bouncing between institutional emails right now. So the best way to get a hold of me is through my Gmail address, which is bhilgren@gmail.com.
Great. I'll pop it in the show notes too. And Hannah, how about you?
Yeah. Oh my gosh. I want to read your thesis. I really hope that during my master's, I did a really small project about Gordon Hampton's One Square Inch of Silence project.
Oh, yeah.
Probably came across that. And I'm really interested in these politics of like trying to make places quiet and what that actually means. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so with me, I'm sort of in the midpoint of my PhD right now. So still sort of in the weeds of things. I'm trying to write up my work about sound and the search for the ivory woodpecker. So that's going to be kind of hopefully submitted this summer and coming out to the world at some point soon. And yeah, I'm just finishing up my data collection in the archives and seeing seeing what's next. And if people want to contact me, I'm on Twitter. It's at Hannah F. Hunter. Or my email address is hannah.hunter@queensu.ca. But yeah, I just wanted to thank you, Claudia, for such a great season. I think animals and sound, like, I've always thought of it as being this quite niche area and it's not huge in animal studies. So I think it's really cool that there was so much focus on it. And I'm sure that it's kind of inspired a lot of people. So
it's been, I would include myself in that too. I'm very much inspired. Every episode I was like trying to juggle all the notes that I was taking with like, you know, going for walks to like come down from all my excitement. So.
Well, that's so good to hear, because that's the, I mean, that's the goal of the podcast, is it's supposed to be kind of a pedagogical tool. I think it was born somewhat of me feeling isolated and feeling a bit, because animal studies is so diverse and it's so connected. And starting my PhD, I wasn't in animal studies. I wasn't even in geography. So I was just like, oh, let me do a PhD, something I know nothing about. And I figured, well, who better to learn from than the actual folks? And it's been really, every episode is just really exciting and great for me. And I'm hoping that it'll become a tool in classrooms and as people kind of go through their own journeys. So I'm really, thank you so much. I'm really happy that it's useful, because obviously you guys know sound better than I do. So I'm happy to hear that it's useful. And thank you so much for sharing and being with us today. And I've definitely got to get some of those references from you for the show notes. But yeah, thank you, thank you, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Claudia.
Well, welcome back. I've just been speaking to you for the whole episode.
I'm here again, everyone. If you haven't had enough of me.
Well, it's the final animal highlight, so it's going to be a good one. It's been such a pleasure having you on for the whole season.
Oh,
really,
it's been so fun.
I've learned a lot, and a lot of your highlights have, like, they shaped some of who I was going to speak to next. You know, you raised, so like the dolphin episode was a direct, you know, directly related to some of the things you said in the highlights. There've been so many like interesting things that you've mentioned in the highlights that have come up in the interviews. So thank you for helping me think through animals and sound a bit more.
It's been super fun to like get to research fun facts about animals and sound. So. Grateful for the opportunity to get to do that. So yeah.
Well, we've got one more to go. So before we say our final farewells, who do you have for us today?
We're going to talk about elephants.
I love elephants. I mean, I'm from South Africa, so I've been fortunate enough to have seen elephants in real life, and they are just gorgeous.
You might think elephants, huge ears, that's mostly how they listen, but there is another way that they listen to things, which I would like to share with everyone today. So for first, you need to know that elephants have vocal cords that are 8 times the size of our vocal cords. Huge. And I guess because of this size, they're capable of sending out 2 forms of sound waves at once. So there's the usual kind of higher frequency ones that we're able to pick up and listen to. So we might be able to listen to some elephants right now. and these travel through the air like our voices do. But they also have low frequency waves that they send out at the same time. And these travel through the earth. So when low frequency sounds are low enough, we call those infrasonic. So that's, we talked before about ultrasonic waves, which are the really high ones that we can't hear. These are really low ones that we can't hear. So they're below the range of human hearing. And the lowest threshold for human hearing is 20 hertz. So it's sound below that. Because of the ways that sound waves travel, high frequency sounds dissipate much quicker and so travel a lot less far than low frequency sounds. And so this is where the elephants come in. So a bioacoustics researcher at Cornell called Katie Payne was among the first to realize that elephants communicated in this infrasonic, ground-based way. And because, as I said, these low frequency sounds travel so far, this means that elephants can communicate with each other over 4 kilometers away, But how do they hear these sounds? Well, Caitlin O'Connor Rodwell found that elephants listen to these infrasonic sounds partially with their feet.
Wow.
This researcher noticed these different listening poses that you could observe elephants going in. So they would stand still, they would pick up their foot and point their toe at the ground. And this was kind of an indication that new information was coming in. So
an indication to other elephants in the herd?
So for us, so if we're looking, if you see an elephant doing this, they might be listening to infrasonic.
Okay, I see.
So this is like seismic communication, and it works really well for elephants because of the incredible sensitivity of their feet. So like all mammals, including humans, I'm going to botch this. Elephants have receptors called Pacinian corpuscles. Or PCs. Let's call them PCs in their skin. And these are hardwired to a part of their brain where touch signals are processed. And in elephants, these PCs are clustered around the edge of their foot. So when picking up a far-off signal, elephants will sometimes press their feet to the ground. And elephants have these really kind of like fatty feet. So when they press their foot to the ground, it spreads out their foot, enlarging the surface area by as much as 20%. So imagine if you had like a partially inflated balloon or football and you like pressed it to the ground and it kind of flattens out. That's what elephants do with their feet. And that allows them to hear these infrasonic sounds that it travels through the ground. So they might be listening to other herds of elephants, or they might be trying to listen for thunderstorms. And there was this, maybe we can link to it in the show notes. There's a really interesting like PBS like short documentary about this, and like one group of elephants hearing a matriarch from really far away for another group of elephants, and like through that knowing that this other group were leaving a watering hole so that the new group could come in for the watering hole. And yeah, and for the thunderstorms, it's a really, obviously they make these low rumbles, so elephants can hear those with their feet, or also with their ears, they can hear with their ears too. But we wouldn't be able to pick this up, right? But the elephants can. And so if it's a really dry or like drought period, they can move towards the thunderstorm and be able to find water.
This is amazing. Right. I mean, it brings forward so many of the aspects we've spoken about, like how many ways there are to experience sound, how many ways there are to listen to sound, that a lot of the ways in which you both listen to and create sound go beyond human ranges, and give meaning to animals in so many different ways. That's wow. Okay, so I just want to reiterate. So you've got high frequency and low frequency sounds,
yeah.
And the high frequency sounds don't travel far distances, but low frequency sounds do. So elephants are able to generate these low frequency sounds and read low frequency sounds, which means that they're able to hear even greater distances than what their ears are capable of.
Yeah, exactly that.
That's amazing.
If people want to know more about, there's a, I know I'm quite orientated towards Cornell because that's where I am right now. So I talk to people and they tell me cool stuff about what's happening. But at Cornell, there's something called the Elephant Listening Project. So if you want to know more about elephant listening, you can find out more there. And I just think it's just a cool way of, you know, we know elephants are cool animals and everyone loves elephants, I think. But it's like a cool, it's a cool entry into their worlds. And as you say, it's really interesting to think about these like sonic worlds that are happening far beyond our comprehension. And
it's also just amazing. So thank you again, Hannah, for sharing all of these great details. I'll make sure to put all the links to these amazing studies on the website.
Yes.
But Thank you. It's been such a pleasure having you on the Animal Highlight and in the Grand Review. And you're the first person who I've had on the show who's not me. So, I mean, other than guests, you're the first you're the first podcast. You know what I mean.
Yeah.
So it's been a real big learning curve for me as well. And I've very much enjoyed having you on the show.
Awesome. I'm going to miss being on, but I'm looking forward to just listening to the future episodes. So, yeah, thank you so much.
Thank you so much to both Bailey and Hannah for a thrilling and interesting conversation. You can hear that I was maybe a bit tired and all over the place, but it was really just so much fun to chat to two fellow grad students. I hope you enjoyed listening. A big, 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 big thank you to Hannah for doing this Animal Highlight on elephants, which was super interesting, but just for being a great co-host highlight person throughout the season. I think she's opened my eyes to the potential of what the Animal Highlight could be, and I'm excited to kind of see when and how things develop. I'm very happy to report that the next season is going to be on animals and biosecurity. There's going to be a little bit of a break in between the end of the season and the beginning of the season on biosecurity, and that's just because I'm going to try a new recording strategy so that the episodes are not so spread out. So let's see how things work. I'll keep you updated. But for now, thank you so much for tuning in. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you again to Apple for sponsoring this podcast, to the Sonic Art Studio and SAP Lab for sponsoring this season, to Jeremy John for the logo, Gordon Clark for the bed music, and to the numerous other people that always help me and cheer me on and share and just say good things about the podcast. I really thank you so much. You guys make everything worthwhile. I'm wishing you a wonderful summer or winter wherever you are. This is The Animal Turn with me, Claudia Hertenfelder.
For more great iRaw podcasts, visit iRawPod.com. That's IRoarPod.com.